I'm Tanya Mosley, and I want to thank you for listening to the Here and Now podcast. I also want to ask you to do something. Support your NPR station with a donation right now at donate.npr.org/now. Your contribution supports the reporting you hear every day, the latest from Washington, where a new administration is preparing to take over, and reporting from across the country on the surge of COVID-19 cases. Your donation ensures that you're hearing a range of voices, the experts, and also the everyday people who are experiencing all of this right now, like we all are. You're also helping to make possible those unforgettable interviews with authors, big thinkers, and creatives in the fine arts and popular culture. Those moments that make you want to listen every day. So make a donation to your NPR station now. Your contribution is more important than ever. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now let's get to the news.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. You may have heard those bells in there. Thank you for being here on this day. We're here to wish you a Merry Christmas. Gather the kids for a story about elves coming up and some beautiful music later. But this day is not merry or bright for many. We've also got the latest news on an explosion in Nashville. And tomorrow, unemployment benefits are set to expire for 14 million Americans. An eviction moratorium ends next week, which could jeopardize as many as 30 million people. Oh, and a government shutdown looms. Everything hinges on President Trump signing the $900 billion relief bill, help for struggling Americans, and funds to keep the government running through next September. So let's bring in Rick Klein, ABC News political director. Rick, thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure. Merry Christmas.
Well, same to you. Look, President Trump essentially left metaphorical rubble behind him when he left Washington to go on vacation to Palm Beach without signing or vetoing the relief bill. It's in limbo, but kind of wrecked. He wanted direct payments of $600 to Americans to be increased to $2,000. House Democrats, of course, jumped right on that. Remind people then what happened yesterday.
Well, what happened is the House Democrats tried to bring forward a proposal to do what the president was asking for. They were blocked by Republicans, and Republicans in turn brought something forward to take some of the foreign aid that was in the bill out of it, as the president also asked, and that was blocked by Democrats. So both sides went home for Christmas for a three-day weekend, but they recognize they're going to have to be right back at it on Monday. Otherwise, right. We've got a whole host of bad things that are about to happen to Americans and to the federal government.
And I want to pick up on what you just said, because Republicans did say, wait a minute, you Democrats are embracing raising the payout to $2,000. But the president also did say he wanted foreign aid reduced, and they felt Democrats should maybe, you know, strike a compromise there. Do they have a point?
Well, they have a point in that the president said it, but the aid amounts that were part of this bill were actually some things that the president requested in his budget. He tracked that almost exactly. And look, a lot of this got lumped together because there was the two major issues, the COVID relief and government funding, that got put together. And it seems like the president, in negotiating this through his team, was confusing and conflating some of the issues. And the Democrats' point is they negotiated this with the Treasury Secretary, Steve Mnuchin, and Republicans on Capitol Hill thought that the president would go along with this. Republicans were as surprised as Democrats that suddenly there were veto threats emanating from a president who, other than raging about the election that he lost and claims that he won, has been really absent from the goings-on in Washington for weeks now.
Yeah. Well, meanwhile, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says the House Democrats will, as you say, try again through a standalone bill on Monday. Just the relief part, I understand. Also, the full House is going to vote on whether to override Trump's veto of the annual defense bill. Why are Republicans choosing this moment? Republicans who have really acquiesced to just about everything this president has asked of them. Why this moment to resist both the raise in the payouts and the defense bill veto?
Well, there are a lot of complicated things going on, but we've been watching for a long time. How long would Republicans stick with President Trump? It turned out that President Trump abandoned Republicans at the end of this term, because this bill that was passed, the defense bill, was crafted by Republicans primarily. And even the COVID relief was something that was very friendly to Republicans and Republican priorities. And I think right now the fact that the president is not going to be president about 3-4 weeks from now is driving some of the breaks that we're seeing in the party ranks. And to the point about resisting the larger payouts, Republicans have suddenly rediscovered their inner deficit hawks. Late in the Trump years, and after a lot of deficit spending around the tax bill and COVID relief, they're suddenly concerned about the national debt. To me, that previews some of the fights that we're going to see under the Biden administration, because we know Joe Biden is going to look to have additional relief payments, and we know that some of those priorities are going to be resisted by Republicans.
Yeah. Look, we know the government could shut down next Tuesday if Trump refuses to sign the spending bill. That's, you know, federal workers, you know, being sent home. But just concentrate it, because I know people are listening. They want to hear what happens. I mean, we know the unemployment benefits. And if the House can't pass something, I mean, what happens to those payouts that were going out to people?
Well, they stop. And it's a terrible gift around the Christmas holidays, because so much of this unemployment extension has been used by people to just keep the lights on and be able to continue to live their lives at some modicum of respectability. That goes away, that extended unemployment insurance. And there's other things like eviction moratoriums that expire as well. So there's a real urgency now. And it's been since April, since there was major COVID-19 relief. But this carries on special urgency because it's the end of the year, because of the holidays, and frankly, because we're in the midst still of this pandemic. People are not able to resume their lives just yet. There is light at the end of the tunnel, but we still are in the tunnel.
Right. We are still in the tunnel, and we don't know if it's a train. Rick Klein, a political director for ABC News, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Great to be with you.
Well, also beginning Monday, passengers flying to the U.S. from the U.K. will be required to have proof of a negative COVID-19 test within 3 days of their flight. More than 50 countries have barred travel from the U.K. or have put restrictions in place as Britain sees many cases of that new variant of the coronavirus. We want to check in on Italy, which was the first European country to be hit hard by the coronavirus back in the winter and spring. Remember those unthinkable images in this sophisticated country of overwhelmed hospitals, a nationwide lockdown in place between March and May, people speaking and singing to each other from balconies. Well, on Wednesday, Italy became the first European country to exceed 70,000 deaths from COVID-19, just as Italians were preparing for their traditional celebrations of Christmas. The BBC's Mark Lowen has been covering the pandemic all year and joins us from Rome by Skype. Mark, 60 million or so population in Italy, 70,000 deaths, more than 2 million infections. How would you characterize the pandemic right now?
I would say, Robin, that it is still in a very devastating second wave, which has torn through the country. And the difference between the first wave and the second one is that in the first wave, you might remember that it was really very focused on the north of Italy, on the much wealthier regions in the north, like Lombardy around Milan, which were very badly hit. But it did not spread down to the poorer south of the country, mercifully, as we thought at that time, because if the hospitals couldn't cope in the north, well, then certainly in the south they wouldn't have been able to cope. But this time, it has hit the south as well. It's hit the whole country. Luckily, over the summer, where there was a bit of a lull in the virus, hospitals actually increased their intensive care facilities and capacities. So they have been able to cope better this year with the second wave. They have not been completely filled, but they have been in a very, very bad state with the second wave. And as you say, deaths now over 70,000, cases over 2 million. And really all this country can hope for as a Christmas gift is some respite in 2021.
Yeah. Well, what form would that take? Is it the vaccine? Are people being vaccinated there?
The vaccinations are going to start on the 27th of December, along with all the other EU countries. And the first in line will be the healthcare workers, those on the front line, those over the age of 80, as it is, I'm sure, where you are as well, Robin. And yeah, they're just absolutely desperate and craving this vaccine, because not only has the has the actual the impact of, on human health been absolutely so devastating, but also on the economy. I mean, back before the second wave really got very bad, they were already forecasting an economic contraction this year of 10%, and now I think it'll probably be even worse. They've had to impose tighter restrictions over the Christmas period, closing bars and restaurants and cafes for much of the Christmas period, and shops as well. So the economic fallout and of course the social impact is going, and the social repercussions are going to be felt for many years to come, I would have thought.
Right. And just briefly, what happened? Is it the same as elsewhere? You know, here in the States, people maybe just traveled more or carried it from one place to another. We remember in the beginning in Italy, outbreaks were traced to people going skiing in alpine countries where, you know, they could trace it right down to the ski house and then bringing it back. And now we understand there was talk of closing borders between Italy and France and countries where there are ski areas, or testing people, or, you know, what is the sense of what happened to bring a second surge?
I think that there was a level of complacency over the summer when cases were just about 100 or so a day, as opposed to the 20, 25, 30,000 a day that we've been seeing in the last few weeks. So people rested a bit on their laurels. Italy flung open its doors to tourists over the summer to try to salvage the tourism season, which makes up about 13% of the Italian economy. And that led to more infections, young people going abroad and bringing it back. People kind of congregating out in the piazzas were quite busy. So, yes, I think that a pretty relaxed summer, and along with Italy being the last country in Europe to restart schools, led to a pretty horrific autumn.
Yeah, and I just should say that, you know, a lot of the spread is with people who have to go out. We don't want to imply people are going skiing. I mean, there are people who have to go to work. They're driving buses, I'm sure, as they are in this country. And that adds in as well. The BBC's Mark Lowen there in Rome. Well, Mark, despite, you know, this surge and hoping for respite, I hope, you know, people there get some, even today, some peace on this Christmas. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin, and season's greetings to you and to all your listeners.
Support for this podcast comes from the Boston Foundation. A resilient city and region relies on the Boston Foundation to bring people together to solve Greater Boston's most serious problems, from the hardships of COVID to the fight for racial equity and other important issues that affect the lives of everyone in our community. Learn how you can help build a Greater Boston that works for everyone by partnering with the Boston Foundation at tbf.org/partner.
In Iceland, we have our own Santa Clauses. They are 13 brothers. They live in the mountains with their parents.
A year ago, before the pandemic, we were lucky to visit Iceland, where we heard a story we thought worth retelling this Christmas Day. It's not, though, about Iceland's sibling Santa Clauses, who have names like Door Slammer and Candle Stealer, and who children try to placate by being good, so when they put their little shoes on the windowsill at night, they will get a gift and not a rotten potato. Or worse, a visit from the Santa's mom.
She would come to town and catch the naughty children. And when I was a kid, I knew that she would cook the kids for dinner.
Yes,
that's terrible. I was afraid of her. She died of starvation.
There you get a sense of Icelanders' dry humor and storytelling skills, maybe born of long, dark winter days with only a few hours of light, and their otherworldly landscape that inspired Tolkien and Jules Verne. It's easy to believe volcanic mountains might be home to ogre Santas or elves.
My name is Sigur Björk Hallstóttir, but everybody calls me Sipa. And we are now in the capital of the elves in Hafnarfjörður.
There, that's good. Are we going anywhere?
Yes, elves. And Sipa is about to give us an elf tour. 54% of Icelanders believe in the so-called hidden people. And the rest?
They don't disbelieve in them.
Yeah. See, the thing is, they don't want to rule it out. I don't see them myself.
I was going to ask, have you seen one?
No, well, I've only seen one in my dream. And it's not important whether you believe the elves are here or not. This is part of the culture. It's just part of life.
Well, we have a map that we are given on the tour. Beautiful little drawings. We'll have pictures at herenow.org. But things like elves like to live near the swimming pools of beautiful homes.
Well, this is a map made by the seer, Erla Stefansdóttir.
Seer in that literally she could see the elves.
Yes, she could see those creatures.
And people, you know, I don't mean to be disrespectful, but people didn't make fun of her. They didn't.
I'm sure some people did. But also, she was respected.
So, we begin our walk.
We just have to cross the street here.
Hearing how when God paid a visit to Adam and Eve was so ashamed her children were dirty, she hid them in the mountains. God declared that what was hidden from him would remain hidden forever, the hidden people. Sirpa's own uncle claimed an elf helped him tend the sheep at night when he was a child, gave him a rock as a gift. Then, when the uncle grew old, he could no longer see the elf.
As an old man, he was looking for the rock he had given him, and he found it in his drawer. He held it in his hand, and the rock vanished. And he told us he was sure his friend was still around and had taken it. Okay, here we need to watch our step. We come this way.
This is enchanted. We are in a beautiful park, a volcanic field of black rock and dark green moss, birch trees and red winter berries. This place is supposedly silly with elves. We scramble up on a huge boulder called Elf Rock.
Okay. You can come up here and see if anybody's home.
Okay.
Watch your step.
People come here to meditate and feel the hidden people energy and maybe ask their forgiveness.
If we cross them, if we try to break down their house or do something they don't like, they will put a spell on us.
Well, we heard of, you know, people trying to build roads.
Yes.
And people protested the building of the roads because it might go through a boulder.
Yeah. A man that studied at the university, he collected stories from older road workers.
Saying what?
Saying when the guys were making a new road, they would come to a rock or a hill and everything would go wrong. And in the end, they would go around the rock, and then everything was okay. Around 1970, they were making a big road out of Reykjavik. And in the middle of the road, there was a big rock, and things started to happen. Guys were falling down, hurting themselves, and people were saying, this is an elf rock, and this is why everything is going wrong here. In the end, it was decided to have somebody come who negotiated with the elves. They moved out, and the rock was moved to the side of the road, and it's still there.
They do seem to be almost a conscience of the country when it comes to caring for the countryside.
Well, when I was growing up, my father had many stories from his family about the elves. And he taught us, his children, respect for nature. I think in many ways, it is. It's a great, great word to use. Conscious of the country. I like that.
All right, here we go. We're looking for elf living spaces.
Oh, yes. We will.
I think most Icelanders you meet, if you would ask them if they believe in elves, trolls, you know, hidden people, they would say, well, I can't outrule that they exist. And that is my answer.
That's Iceland's young, progressive Minister of the Environment, Gudmundur Gudbrandsson, the son of farmers who went to school in the U.S.
I was telling my classmates, especially from the U.S., the elves and trolls in Iceland and the hidden people, I could read from their eyes and their expressions, he's crazy, he's so crazy. Mm-hmm. Until I met a student from Hawaii, and she was like, yeah, of course. Yeah, no, I understand. We have those two. Two volcanic islands. Is there a connection there? I ask myself. So what is it in our environment that makes us be more likely to believe in hidden people?
To him, it's the rock formations. As a child, he was told they were trolls, frozen into contorted positions when the sun hit them.
And, you know, we can point at something in the landscape that is sort of a proof.
Personally, I don't think that has nothing to do with it. It only has to do with when this is accepted, which is still in Iceland, then everybody dare to talk about their experiences. That's why so many believe in elves.
That's Professor Magnus Skarphéðinsson at the Elf School in Reykjavik. Actually, Magnus's delightfully cluttered apartment, books and elf figurines piled high. We've pulled up chairs in the small parlor with five students from around the world as Magnus, who looks a little Santa-like himself, tells stories and takes questions.
We have hundreds, we have thousands of such stories. We collect them. We store them in special files.
The climate change and the elves connected, or at least the disappearing of the elves.
That's right. I met more than 900 Icelanders and 500 foreigners from 40 countries that have seen elves. 65 or 70 have met them regularly. The hidden people in the elves is always asking them, humans, why do you pollute so much? You have to stop this global warming and stop this pollution. You will kill yourself and you will also kill us. You have to change.
When did this start and why do you think here?
There's only one reason why we have the elves. That is because the Enlightenment that started in Europe in 1600, which was a very good movement, very, changed the world more than word can express, but it has price. It killed faith in the world, cleaned out all myth and mythology. And the Enlightenment never came to Iceland. That's why we have still have the elves.
Yeah, I think you have to ask your First Nations about that.
That's Tina Bucher from Germany.
You think that in the American Indian, the indigenous people probably had some of the same beliefs that were wiped out?
Yeah, I think spirits like everywhere in the world.
Can I just ask, does everybody in this room who's at the class here now, are you here now because you also have a belief in elves or you wanted to find out more?
So I believe and I know that they exist.
I just wanted to know if I could find them myself one day.
Yeah, I think there is a connection with nature.
I'm very interested in myths and legends in Ireland.
That's Patricia McAteer, before that her husband John from Ireland. We also heard from a woman named Sunshine from New York. But John and Patricia from Ireland actually claim sightings.
Mm-hmm. Mine was in Donegal, in a very sacred site called Ungreenon. And the elf was halfway up the mountain, almost like the age of about a 14-year-old, but much older in features. Did have pointy ears and was in the expected green-brown outfit. Was very wary and cautious of me.
Are you sure that...
Absolutely positive. Yeah. It was an elf. Absolutely and utterly positive. And he just went like that.
Professor, what do you say to people who are going to hear this and just think you are all out of your minds?
Yes. But the most reason why 54% believe in elves is all Icelanders know some witnesses. Their grandma or grandpa or parent, when they tell you their elf experience, they are very sincere. This happened to me. And that's why people dare to talk about that experience. This is accepted part of the culture.
Elves are wonderful creatures, and we take them seriously.
That is Siggi Hilmarsson. In Iceland, he taught us to bake bread in hot volcanic springs. We want to leave you with his thoughts on elves.
If we come across a huge rock, we sometimes get a special person that speaks to the elves and get, you know, permission.
You're smiling, but you're serious.
Yeah, it's a smiling, serious thing. There is a song that you should listen to. The lyrics go like, are elves perhaps men? Eru álvar kannski menn? Eru álvar kannski menn? We smile, but we take it seriously.
A story from our 2019 visit to Iceland, our Christmas gift to you. And on this day, keep an eye out. You never know what you might see. President Trump has been briefed on a vehicle explosion this morning in downtown Nashville, which blew out windows and charred the street, knocking over a police officer on the scene. Local police have now been joined by the FBI and the ATF, and investigators say they believe the explosion was intentional. Nina Cardona from member station WPLN has the latest from Nashville. And Nina, we know the explosion was early this morning. What do we know about what happened and why were police officers there?
Well, police say that They received a call of shots fired around 5:30 this morning, so they went to the scene to check out what was going on with that. And when they were there on the street, they noticed a recreational vehicle that somehow looked suspicious. And looking around at it, we aren't sure exactly what it was that raised their suspicion, but they did call in the bomb squad because they were so concerned and went ahead and started evacuating the nearby buildings. And the bomb squad was en route when that RV exploded at 6:30 this morning.
Boy, if people saw the pictures, just a huge plume of black smoke and flames. Well, people, are wondering more about what happened. Here's Don Aaron from the Metro Nashville Police Department at a press conference this morning.
When the officers got to 2nd Avenue North on the shots fired call, this RV was parked there, and there were circumstances about the RV that caused the officers to request the bomb squad.
Do we know any more about what those circumstances were? And do we know, Nina, if perhaps the police were lured to the area with the call of shots fired?
Well, of course, that is the question, because it sounds as if nothing turned up from that call of shots fired. Nothing seemed to actually back that up when they got to the scene.
Yeah. Do we know what the building was? He said 2nd Avenue North. Do we know? I mean, it's Christmas, so hopefully not
right. Well, it's actually, it's 2nd Avenue, that couple of blocks around there is a historic area. These are, imagine, kind of brick buildings that are just a few stories tall. It's also a very touristy area. All of those businesses along there are things like clubs and bars and souvenir shops. This is the kind of place that on any weekend night and all through the year, even during the pandemic, you normally see incredible crowds of people teeming around. Not many people actually live in the area, so Christmas is the day when it is the emptiest and the quietest.
Yeah, so there's just so many unanswered questions. But meanwhile, talk more about this fiery scene this morning. That must have been shocking.
Oh, absolutely shocking to wake up to. And people were woken up miles away by the blast. We have been reminded that with our limestone bedrock here in Nashville, we feel blasts farther than you might in some other places. Huh. But people miles away were woken up, shaken out of their sleep and wondering what was going on, only to look outside and see plumes of smoke coming from downtown.
Now, we know we've mentioned all sorts of agencies are there. Is there a fear? I mean, are people, officials looking for other suspicious cars, whatever that suspicion was, fear that there may be more?
Well, they say that they have not seen indication to, there's no tips or anything like that, but they have sent bomb-sniffing dogs around downtown to check for more explosives, just in case.
Oh, boy. Nina Cardona at WPLN in Nashville. Nina, thanks so much.
Thank you.
. 2020 was a horrible year in a lot of categories. Let's look at climate. The year started with Australia's massive wildfires. Now it's vying for the title of hottest year on record. We won't know that officially until mid-January. And it's the year with the most hurricanes. Remember when we had to dig deep into the Greek alphabet to name them all? So today, a look at the top climate stories of 2020, which Mark Fischetti has been compiling. He's senior editor at Scientific American. Mark, despite the topic, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you, to listeners, and thanks for having me.
There are some bright spots. Let's start with one you view as hopeful, Joe Biden's electoral victory. It will have huge climate implications. Tell us why.
Interestingly enough, coal plants have been closing, and largely because natural gas has been taking a greater share of the energy market. So our emissions should be going down a little just because of that. And yet, because of so many regulatory rollbacks by the Trump administration, the rollbacks could add up to the equivalent of 1.8 billion tons of carbon dioxide added to the atmosphere that wouldn't have been added had those regulations not been rolled back. So the Biden administration can do a lot to really change that math.
Yeah, and also Joe Biden has pledged to rejoin the Paris Accords, has pledged to strengthen some of these environmental rules that have been rolled back. And your second pick is interesting. You say there's been a drop in emissions during the coronavirus shutdowns. We know that's not at all going to offset the emissions that are created. However, you say it makes a nice runway for trying to get transportation off of fossil fuels. Explain.
Right. You know, there's always question of, well, if we made this change or if we passed this bill, how much difference would it really make? So globally, greenhouse gas emissions dropped by about 7% when shutdowns were really far-reaching. Mostly what changed is people weren't driving or flying. They were certainly still burning up the computers at home and all that. So it shows you that a fairly sizable chunk of emissions comes from transportation. We knew that, but changing transportation could have a big difference alone. It's really an interesting case.
Yeah. And by the way, we talked about everything that's been rolled back by the Trump administration. What are some of the top things you think the Biden administration should quickly reinstitute?
Well, speaking of transportation, mileage standards, those were getting tighter and tighter under the Obama administration, and the Trump administration basically canceled them out and put in much weaker rules. So the Biden administration could essentially do the same, rescind the Trump's It's a Safer, Affordable Fuel Efficiency Vehicle rule. So that would greatly cut emissions from transportation. And then the Clean Power Plan, which was so political for so long during Trump's era, that basically was stopped. So if it got put back into place, that would tighten up emissions from power plants across the country.
Next on your list, hurricanes. 30 named tropical storms, 13 hurricanes, 6 major hurricanes, the most storms on record, surpassing the 28 in 2005. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. Obviously, that this is important, but remind us why.
For a long time, scientists were saying, well, warmer atmosphere, more moisture in the atmosphere will make hurricanes stronger. It wouldn't necessarily create more storms per year, but that's really changing. And this past year has been, as you were enumerating, a lot of records set. So there's a change in thinking that maybe it also does mean more storms. So, of course, stronger storms and more storms means just that much more damage.
And where does it go from there? How far does it increase? We talk about things like climate refugees, people having to move inland in Louisiana.
So where does it go from there?
Wildfires, the Australian fires, the beginning of the year. I mean, you know, animals burned, people couldn't breathe, you know, climate refugees there. Tell us more about what makes this a top climate story.
Wildfires, it's hard to look the other way. Australia was a terrible year. In California, the amount of acres burned this year was twice the previous record in the state. There's more wildfires in Alaska and the high Arctic even, which is previously sort of unheard of. And it's a number of effects that are combining to cause this warmer temperature, but more importantly for forest fires, drier soil. And it means snow melts earlier, so the number of weeks where the soil is dry is longer, and all these things add up to more chances for fire.
Next on your list, stopping methane leaks in the oil, gas, and coal infrastructure. I have to admit, this is something we do not give as much attention as perhaps we should. Explain that.
Carbon dioxide is what everybody's familiar with as a greenhouse gas. Methane's sort of the next biggest culprit, but it's increasing quite quickly. And most of it comes from agriculture and notably the gas and oil industry. So methane's the main component of natural gas, and natural gas is rising, as we said earlier. So there's more and more leaking, and you can stop it. You know, the natural sources, there's not a lot you can do about. But leaks in pipelines and production facilities, you can do something about. And it really could actually save the companies money because they're wasting that gas in essence.
You list environmental justice as a top climate story. How disproportionately communities of color are affected by climate change. In presenting his climate team, Joe Biden said he was specifically committed to facing climate change by delivering environmental justice. Talk more about that.
If we think about various recent events, the hardest hit communities were the poorest communities. You know, sea level rise is an issue that really is threatening a number of low-lying areas and coastal areas and islands where you've got many indigenous people living. You know, up in Alaska, in the coast, there's a really odd thing happening where sea ice is disappearing. And so, first of all, it makes hunting of whales and other animals much more difficult. But there are waves that are now breaking onto the shore where there never were waves before. And it's literally like barreling into the indigenous towns along the shoreline. So there's a lot of these effects. Certainly in the cities, that's gotten a lot of attention too this year. So if you're going to clean up sources of emissions and sources of pollution in general, maybe start in the places where it's needed most and where the people who live there need help to make these changes happen.
Yeah. And I want to jump in and ask a question here about the pandemic. As we understand it, most scientists agree that this was a virus that was started by a bat that might have been driven by its environment because of changing climate. Is your sense that viruses, pandemics, are connected to climate change and we may see more because of that?
So there's some really interesting linkages here. Deforestation, what you're doing in part is you're flushing out the animals that normally live there and are happy to just stay there. So bats are a carrier of lots of these kinds of pathogens, and they're getting flushed out of their native habitats by us cutting down the forest, essentially. And that's a big factor within climate change, too. The more you slash and burn, the less trees there are to absorb carbon dioxide and the more emissions you create. So as a source of potential pandemics, we raise the stakes there. And then completely on the other end of this, in inner cities, diesel fuel emissions carry small particles, and it's been shown they can actually carry virus particles a fair distance, a lot more than the 6 feet that we always hear about. So if you think about an inner city where diesel emissions are wafting into the apartments and all that, and if there's coronavirus around, they're potentially carrying coronavirus. So all these things are interconnected in some pretty surprising ways.
Wow, yeah. You also want to remind listeners that climate change isn't atmospheric only. We've got ocean temperatures and currents. We visited Iceland a year ago, and one of the country's biggest fisheries, the fish they're catching, that's shifting. Just briefly, what's your biggest concern about oceans at end of 2020?
I think your story in Iceland is a very good example. The oceans are maybe warming a little, but with a lot of glaciers melting and ice sheets melting, especially in Greenland, that area, there's more fresh water that enters the ocean, so it changes the level of salt. So if the temperature changes a little, the salt level changes a little, the fisheries, they move. You know, they want to go where their conditions are prime for them, and also where their food sources go, which has a lot of implications for people who depend on local fisheries for their own sustenance.
Well, Mark Fischetti, some would say this is a dispiriting conversation at a time of year where we're supposed to be filled with hope and love and at the very least have a spirit of faith. Do you have that, that some of these things you've talked about are going to be addressed or even turned around?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you think about what can we do in a number of these cases, we can change the regulations, make them tougher. We can stop the methane leaks. We can certainly improve environmental justice and justice in general. So there are definitely actions that we can take. You can be defeatist about this, but, you know, we all live here, so let's do something about it.
There you go. Scientific American's Mark Fischetti on the top climate stories of 2020. Mark, thank you, and, you know, Merry Christmas.
Thank you, Robin, and Merry Christmas to you all as well.
And if you have kids unwrapping presents this Christmas Day, you may want to consider filming them. Ryan Casey, a 9-year-old YouTuber, just raked in nearly $30 million this year reviewing toys and making videos with his parents. For more on what's buzzing on social media this week, we're joined by Femi Okeh, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. Femi, happy holidays. Merry Christmas to you.
Oh, thank you. I do both. I do holidays and Merry Christmas because I've lived in the US for so long. I speak both languages. And I'm going to say hello, Christmas. Hello, Christmas, Robin, which in the UK would be hilarious. Greeting. How are you, Robin?
Well, I'm just fine. And so is Ryan Casey. Let's talk about, one of YouTubers' top earners. He does science experiments. He has these unboxing videos, plays a lot of make-believe with his dad on his YouTube channel, Ryan's World. Here's a clip where he's talking to a cardboard Santa about visiting a pretend hotel. Let's listen.
Santa?
Ho, 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 Ryan!
What are you doing in my house, Santa?
Well, I have this new North Pole hotel opening up. I was wondering if you could check it out and review it.
Sure. Since it's made by Santa, it must be great.
Okay, off they go into the episode. Femi, you know, you get the sense he's either going to have a lot of therapy or be a well-adjusted creative kid. And his parents seem to be a big part of it. Talk about this, what you see as a winning formula.
Yeah, well, it all started as fun when Ryan was 4 years old. He was watching videos of kids on YouTube and he wanted to do it as well. So now he's 9. He's still sweet. He's bubbly. His mother is an educator. She quit her job to help make the video, so she knows how to connect with kids. Ryan's got two little twin sisters, Emma and Kate. They're adorable. As too is his dad, who pops up in the videos as well. So the entire mix is this bright, silly, fun family. And they're all basically like a real-life cartoon, which I think is part of their appeal. But here's the but here. A lot of product placement on the Ryan's World YouTube channel. And they have been accused of misleading preschoolers, because if you're that little, you're not going to know, is this toy an ad? Is this toy being a sponsored product? So there has been some pushback about that. In 2020, Ryan earned $29 million.
Unbelievable. Who were some of the other top earners this year?
David Dobrik. He specializes in comedy stunts. One of my favorites was during the beginning of the lockdown when he gave away Xbox One X games to strangers who were shocked that that would happen. Rhett and Link, the comedy duo, also in the top 10 list of YouTubers' high earners. From Good Mythical Morning, they earned $20 million this year. And Mr. Beast is a newcomer into the high rollers on YouTube influencers, Jim Donaldson. He earned $24 million. It's fun, it's goofy, it does stunts. One of my favourites one was when he was pretending to be a newsman, ringing up people, connecting with people quite randomly and giving them thousands of dollars. The reaction was so beautiful, so poignant, that it even touched Mr. Beast himself. And to see those videos, you just have to look at Mr. Beast on YouTube to see why are they making millions of dollars on YouTube and we are not.
We will link people up at herenow.org. But meanwhile, let's go to Facebook, because 300,000 users have signed up to attend a virtual second inauguration for President Trump on January 20th. Of course, he did not win. He will not be inaugurated. The real inauguration is for Joe Biden. But talk about the creators of this event.
So this is not a joke. This is a real virtual event that is planned for the 20th of January, 2021 at 12 p.m. Eastern. So the group who put it together, they describe themselves as a grassroots collection of private individuals. They're supporters of President Donald J. Trump. And they are putting on this virtual event to basically is counter-programming against the real inauguration. And Facebook have very carefully labelled this as it's misinformation. They have a link where you can get tickets for this virtual inauguration of President J. Trump. And you can get the tickets there. But Facebook say that this is not accurate election information. This is where you need to click to get accurate information and say what you just said and what many journalists continue to say when Trump supporters say and claim that President J. Trump should be president next year after January the 20th. 66,000 people say that they are definitely attending, and more have said that they are interested, Robin. So it gives you an idea of the little corners of the internet and social media where there are different points of view.
Look, we've only got a minute, and I want to make sure we get another corner of the universe there. It's Black Twitter. You've got one story to tell us? Real quick.
Oh, yes, I do. All right. So December the 21st, for various reasons, became known as the Negro Solstice, the day when people on Black Twitter would get superpowers. It was all to do with Lottie Dot, who said, on this day, we would wake up as people of colour with amazing superpowers. Black Twitter had a field day. If you look out for Black Twitter and Negro Solstice, you'll see some of the very, very funny memes. And then also some pushback from Janny G, who says, you're going to owe that girl an apology when December the 21st hits and we all wake up as X-Men. I am not an X-woman. But
Femi, I'm going to have to leave it at that.
Next year.
Yep. I'll hook people up. Femi Okay of the stream Al Jazeera English. Thank you.
You're so welcome.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.